Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. I like this kind of language, fully conscious. You notice in Buddhism we're usually talking about the same thing and just trying to point to it in different ways from different angles. So whether we call it mindfulness or awareness or whatever. So I've been using this idea of like being fully conscious more recently. And again, to just be fully conscious of this moment without comment, you have to stop. Don't you? You have to kind of stop and say, what's it really like? And that's not a commentary. So even if I say to you, what's it like? And you make a judgment about it, that's not really being fully conscious. It's making a comment on the way things are. So learning to come to no thought. Not getting rid of thought. There's nothing wrong with thought. But just training and remembering first and foremost that this moment is this way. Because if we don't get to that point, then whatever effort we're making to be peaceful and to find our way in our own spiritual life can be kind of misappropriated, because we're really not aware of the way things are. We have some opinion, we have some judgment. Quite often, you know, the opinion might be quite wholesome in a sense of we want to be better people, but it might just be a reaction to the way things are from another habit. So it gets kind of compounded. So it seems to me that would be a very much a first step in the practice of knowing yourself and understanding yourself. And that's different than trying to become a good person. Not that we're saying that's not a good thing. It's different than trying to acquire something. It's different than trying to figure something out or whatever. It's just simply awakening to the way things are. So like Akka is now kindly doing our gardens for us, you know, and you come to the garden and just, oh, it's this way now. And then I say, oh, I haven't watered that plant. And then I respond to that and I water the plant. But I have to actually look at the garden, don't I? If I just kind of zip by it and head for breakfast, and I never really look at it, never notice it, then I cannot give it an appropriate response. And in the same vein, quite often we kind of zip by things going on in our minds, and we're not fully cognizant of them, not fully conscious of them, and then they can run our inner life. We're kind of know, but we don't know. So all spiritual traditions talk about being present in the moment. But it's not the kind of presence that a person suffering from Alzheimer's has, or that person, you probably have all read that account of someone in the 70s, I think, who had a really bad, very, very, very bad case of epilepsy, and they didn't understand the different functions of the brain. I can't remember quite how it worked, but they operated on the hypothalamus or something in there, and they took that out, and it cured the epilepsy, but the person had no more memory. So the person was in the present moment, but they didn't know anything. They didn't know the last minute how it had passed. So their memory was destroyed. So we're not talking about that kind of presence, because that would be pathological and you couldn't function. So the kind of presence we're talking about is one which understands memory, which understands that the past and future are important to function. So functionally, memory is fine. So I remember maybe that there's a contractor who is very, very good at doing guttering, and I need to do some more guttering. And I phone him up and I say, what's it going to cost? And he gave me a good deal last time. I trust him this time, and I get the guttering done. So I have the past and the future. So that's functional memory. But where it becomes troublesome is when the habits of consciousness, of mind, of thought, of emotion manifest, and we're not really fully aware of them, and then our inner world is driven by them. So where we, like, let's say I'm in India and I'm eating rice, and any of you who have eaten rice have probably also eaten rocks. So you're chewing on your rice and chuck, 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 and crack. And I don't know about you, when I cooked rice, when I was a layman, I cooked rice in India, I made sure I sieved it really, really well. So you're eating your rice and crack. You bite on a stone. The first thing is at least disappointment, but probably annoyance and maybe anger. So that manifests, and that manifests because of one has been disappointed or one has been stressed. So when we get stressed, when we're tired, or when something happens which we're not expecting or that we don't want, then that gives a kind of opportunity for the defilements of mind to come up, greed, hatred, delusion, various kinds of ways. So I'm chewing on the rice, a bite in the rock, crack. Maybe I lose a filling. I lost a few fillings in India. I don't know about you. And then the aversion arises. Now, if I'm fully cognizant and conscious of the way things are, then I know aversion feels this way. And I wait it out. And I wait it out, and I wait it out, and the aversion finds some kind of normality. But if I'm not awake, I'm not aware, then what happens is my inner thoughts are driven by aversion. This is a kind of coarse example. And I find that this tendency towards aversion or anger then has a chance to grow in the mind, you know, like fruition. And so then I think angry thoughts and angry thoughts and angry thoughts. And maybe I yell at the chai wall or whoever's giving the rice. So that's memory driven by defilement, driven by kilesa. If, however, I'm fully awake and I can remember this capacity to be fully conscious, then those are the areas which are terribly important, because that's where there is a kind of choice in mind to go towards to take the path of peace or to take the path of habit, and the path of habit leads to more suffering. And when we get stressed, that's, you know, sometimes like in Buddhism, people ask us, is like the law of karma deterministic? Is it like fatal? Like, am I just have to live out my karma? Or is there free choice? Well, what you see happening is in those times of stress, it's like as the kilesa manifests, that's where your mindfulness has to be strong. Because if it's not, then your fate is to go down that pathway. So it's very, very important to be mindful when it's the most difficult time to be mindful, obviously. That's the most important time. And so our training, if our training in meditation in general is based upon something other than awakening to the way things are, then we could really miss the whole boat. If we're just trying to acquire a certain state of mind, a certain state of peacefulness and excluding everything else, and we don't understand this the importance of being fully conscious, then when we are stressed, when things do come up, when we need a lot of strength, we don't have the strength because we've misunderstood meditation, or we've misunderstood the path of practice or the path of awareness. So the path of awareness or mindfulness is not, it's not a demand that we don't feel these different defilements of mind. No, it's like saying, can you be fully conscious when they arise, when I get stressed? So the person that I feel annoyed at, or the thing that I'm enthralled with, right there is this capacity to remember things are just this way now. Not a judgment. That's not a judgment. Then we can make better and better choices, and we do have to make choices, whether we're heedless or not. Sometimes it's just like one feels like lonely states of mind or states of doubt, and then another kind of defilement arises. It might be some kind of greed. So I seek compensation in food, something to distract the loneliness. I seek compensation in video media or whatever. And so to be fully conscious of, say, something like loneliness, and loneliness is just this way, to really awaken to it is hard to do. Hard to do because it's unpleasant. It's not gratifying. It's not the same as eating a nice meal, or it's not distracting. In fact, everything in me wants to distract. And you can see like loneliness or something like that is also a kind of stressful situation. It comes up. And it, that's where the kind of, this is a kind of fork in the road where you either have the capacity to remember and not go the way of suffering, not go the way of attachment, not go the way of self-view and all that, or fall into habit. And that's what we're all struggling with, I think. All of us probably in the same boat. We might have very, very good intentions, and yet we find ourselves in these habitual holding patterns of worry and fear and greed or whatever. And to accept that that's okay. That's just the practice seems to be very slow for most of us. It's much slower than we might have expected. But to remember, it's not so much about becoming anything different, but it's about remembering to not grasp that which is the cause of suffering. That's different. So it's not a demand that you be perfect, but it's just a kind of clarity. Now, in meditation practice, you take something very simple. Let's say you're sitting in the room, you're feeling hot maybe you've forgotten to put the fan on, and maybe there's a lot of people in the room, and after 10 or 15 minutes you feel like you've had enough, and maybe you have some pain. And so that's like stress. You're not getting what you want. You're getting what you don't want. And this stress thing allows the defilement of aversion to come up. I don't want to be here. And then the mind starts to think, doesn't it? Oh God, half an hour more. And that seems like permanence. It seems like for the next 30 minutes, which will be an eternity, I'm going to have the same kind of discomfort I'm feeling now, the same kind of unhappiness I'm feeling now. And the mind starts to think. You start to think. And that's attachment. That's what I mean by attachment. But if one has the skill of mindfulness and awareness and being fully conscious that as the meditation proceeds and you start to feel discomfort, annoyance or aversion to the bodily feelings that are into the room you're in, and you are fully present to that, and you're fully awake to that, fully conscious of that, you can label it if you want or whatever, it's this way now, it feels this way now, and you stay with that, then you get the insight that feeling, that perception of permanent discomfort for the next 30 minutes is just a perception. It's just something that's created by the stress. And as you sit through it, you find quite often it's, you know, maybe a minute, 2 minutes or something, and then it goes to neutrality again because you've been fully conscious. Now, I'm not talking about like severe pain or chronic pain or abject pain. Those have a different energy and character about them. But just that little thing, which I think we all have experienced in meditation, that not only brings you to peace, but it also begins to inform consciousness in a way that it's okay, that this feeling of this perception of pain or whatever, it is changing. Now, it's not just like a doctrinal statement. It's an intuitive understanding in your own heart. It's what we call sampajanya, or clear comprehension. So these two words you find in our text, sati sampajanya, mindfulness and clear comprehension, are like the clear comprehension is something that builds as your practice has more and more insight. You just know the way things are, and not just in a kind of abject functional way that it's hot, but all that extra which we create around it, all the greed, hatred, and delusion which we tend to, which we have tended in the past to follow, you begin to not believe in that. You know it in a different way. And that's a tremendous source of freedom. That's a tremendous source of freedom. And that's what we mean by clear comprehension. Not just book knowledge. It's not an opinion. I can have an opinion about something, but when push comes to shove and I feel fear, I feel annoyance, or I feel disappointment, what's going to come up is not so much book knowledge as practice. What does your practice do with this? So sati is that, and I've been kind of, you know, I use these two words a lot in my practice, watchfulness and availability. I find these two words very, very interesting for my own practice, and I try to bring them constantly into mind. So if I'm if I'm working in Makuti or I'm I was writing the president's report yesterday, we have an AGM tomorrow or whatever, and it's just watchful and available. And this sense of available is for me what we mean by non-attachment, non-grasping, where we're available to the way things are. So when I am preoccupied, like let's say just in a meditation, you know, just when I'm preoccupied with low-level mutterings, you know, we all have that. You're kind of there, but not there. Low-level sleepiness, you know, the head not quite on the shoulder, sort of going towards the sternum, or body not quite there, and the mind not quite there, sort of in the foggy oatmeal state, not quite bright, huh? Or just sort of planning, kind of planning in the background, just sort of minor low-level whinging and whining. Quite often that's going on. We kind of know, but we don't know. We're not really present, but we are present. We're not totally absent. So you know, kind of bringing that clarity to the mind. How would you do that? How do you do that for yourself? Well, I use language. I don't know about you. I use language. I use the body, and then I try to develop language, which really is from my own insights, from my own understanding, and this I think is part of Satisampajanya. Mindfulness and clear comprehension are the words that we have from the text. But then I think we have additional words because, you know, we are creative in that way. Your language does affect us. We pick up language in different ways, each of us. And so the language of one teacher might not suit, but not the language of another teacher might suit, or a combination of languages. But when we are preoccupied with past and future in this unskillful way, In the unskillful way of worry or aversion or annoyance or self-disparagement or resentment or fear or greed or whatever, when we're preoccupied in that way, we're not available, that's for sure. We're not available. And that non-availability has a kind of two-part problem to it. It's, first of all, it's not peaceful. You know, so we're kind of losing out. And it's also not attentive to the way things are, so it's not available to the way things are, just in a functional sense. So that, but I think even more so, it does not allow for any deeper insight into consciousness, into what it means to be a human being, what it means to have to be incarnate in an emotional, physical kind of setting. And as long as that we're not available to that, our practice cannot deepen. Our practice always remains at a kind of superficial level of self and thought, self and thought, self and other. And that's actually, you know, the thinking mind and its self-perceptions and perceptions of others and kind of family, historical identities, national identities, it's very superficial. It's just perceptions. It's just stuff in the mind. It's not very, very deep. It's real in the sense that it's there. We are conditioned by that. But the deeper sense of what it's like to be a human being, or what the possibilities of human birth are about, the deeper possibilities of silence and peace are unavailable because we're not available. We're preoccupied with the old, with the dead, with the kind of regurgitation of habit going on and on and on and on. So how do you become available? Well, you awaken. It's not so difficult. Not so difficult. So if that's a model I find very, very helpful, then whatever meditation object I do or whatever physical activity I'm involved in, if I make that a practice to do what I do, to try to do it well, it's the best of my ability in this, and begin to see, well, just be available to this now, to doing this now, to finish, just, you know, being available to this physical activity or administrative activity or meditative activity, just be available to that now. On one hand, usually the work gets better done, which is handy, saves you a bit of time. But more profoundly, the mind begins to abide in the present in a way which is insightful, which is informed. So Satisampajanya, mindfulness and clear comprehension. When I don't have clear comprehension, that you could say is attachment. So I'm caught up in maybe some kind of fantasy of what I'm going to create or do or own or buy in the future, or I'm, you know, some old memory comes up of some kind of a divorce or something like that, and I'm caught in the resentments again as they go on. And that is not clear comprehension. That's definitely not clear comprehension. Judging that and thinking, oh, I shouldn't have those feelings. That's not clear comprehension because it's still based on a sense of self and other. But awakening to, let's say I've had a bad divorce last year, and this year it's the anniversary of that divorce, and I get a letter from the lawyer, and the lawyer fees come in, and my mind explodes into aversion or whatever. That's very difficult to handle. But if I awaken to that, I'm stressed now. I'm not getting what I want. I'm afraid I might get something else, and I'm really stressed. And so that's when the defilements come up real strong. And that's where the practice has to be strong. So if I've understood this, clear comprehension doesn't mean that I get the lawyer's notice with great joy and say, oh, that's nice. I owe $40,000 or something like that. No, I really feel that because I'm human. I'm susceptible to this because I am vulnerable. But I have enough clear comprehension to awaken and be available to this uprising now. This very difficult sense of maybe a fear or anger or resentment. Not dismissing it, not denying it, but being available to it. And if I'm available to that, then that whole availability has, in a Buddhist sense, has in it this sort of informed awareness, satisampajanya, informed comprehension. This is not permanent. This is not self. This is historical. It's got energy. I have to be patient. I have to be determined. All that, maybe without words, maybe without words, but it's all there as this difficult manifestation plays out in my consciousness. And my consciousness is a kind of stage, isn't it, where things do manifest. Not through any fault, just through the difficulties of life, they manifest through me. And then if I become the actor on the stage, then I suffer. But if I allow that to be the way it is, and yet not run with it with ego and with self, then it does dissipate, it does liberate, it does go away from consciousness. And that availability then doesn't really change. So I'm available to the pain. But I'm also available to the insight that pain ceases. I'm available to the critical judging mind. I know that critical judging mind. I'm available to that. It goes through and I see that it ceases. It changes. I'm not that. This is anicca. And I become much more free. Whereas the tendency to either believe in that means that I just perpetuate those cycles, or the tendency to think I shouldn't be like that is also a perpetuation of self and ego. We live responsible lives, so our what is most important in this kind of a practice is a kind of moral integrity, ethical integrity, and this is a great protection too, because when we do get stressed in some way or temptations come up or whatever, then our moral boundaries are sometimes challenged. People think, well, I'll cheat or I'll be unfaithful or whatever. And when those kind of stresses come up and we don't have strong integrity, strong moral integrity, then it is really dangerous, and it's really dangerous. In most cases, we usually don't get that stressed, but you know, think about people in states of warfare or that, how challenged they must be not to kill someone or not to really hurt someone because everything is stressing them out. So when we have a foundation of like moral integrity and social responsibility, where it is my duty, say, as a senior monk, to try to uphold the principles and try to be a good role model and etc., etc. Those are good things, aren't they? They make me rise to a kind of mature level of functioning in the world. And then that in me, which is, you know, selfish and childish and stupid, I can watch that too. I can say, oh yeah, that's the way it is now. And not feel kind of guilty about having adolescent emotions coming into consciousness at the age of 66 or feelings of whatever, negative feelings. There's nothing wrong with that. They just are the way they are. But if I'm fully conscious of it, let's say if I get some adolescent emotion coming into consciousness at my age, which happens sometimes, it comes into consciousness, but that's not my fault. You know, I don't wake up in the morning and think, I think I'll be a brat at about 8 o'clock today. It's just bratness comes up, doesn't it? So as it comes into consciousness, and fully, yeah, this is a 16-year-old. And I'm fully aware of that, then it has no power. Because I'm available. I'm available to that too. I'm available to everything. Availability to everything. And so it comes through consciousness and it ceases. And what gives one the faith that that works? Well, it's experience. What gives one faith that any other way, like attachment, doesn't work is experience. I've been burned by this enough times, trying to get rid of it or acting it out. No, this is the way it is now. One sits in the middle, one burns with it or whatever, and then it ceases. So this idea of clear comprehension, this sort of deepening of insight, deepening of understanding, comes in all manner of ways, all manner of ways. And that's just being a mature human being, really, satisampajanya. Watchfulness is this capacity to be attentive, right? It's not controlling. Sometimes we need to. Obviously, we're doing something difficult with a sharp knife, or we're watching the burners on the stove, and we have to be quite concentrated and focused. But watchfulness is more than that. It's a broader thing. It's just the sense of being present to the way things are. And then this clear understanding and comprehension. What is the path to suffering, and what is the path to liberation from suffering? What is attachment to foolishness, and what is the liberation from foolishness in various ways? And so to have faith in that, to have faith, and so sit and practice again, you get really like very subtle insights just around that, just around like a bit of discomfort. And you're fully conscious right through the discomfort. It comes, your mind starts to create perceptions, you watch it and it ceases and it's gone. And that's what informs the time when life is more stressful, when it's more difficult, because that has gotten deep into you. Insight goes deep into you. It's different than an intellectual position or a theory, isn't it? It's something in your heart. Sometimes we call that intuition. Sometimes people have difficulty with the word intuition. Sometimes we call it wisdom, clear comprehension. But what is it about our minds that we can be present to life and understand it in a deeper way than we did when we were 16? There is something there, isn't there? Huh? You call it life experience or wisdom. And in the Buddhist sense, it really is taking out of this whole sense of taking it personally. You know, this kind of terrible infection we have around these things, and kind of with guilt or shame or self-disparagement or blame of others or blame of ourselves. We're trying to extract that bit and see it just as it is. And so awareness of body is very, very helpful. Awareness of mood as mood, of mind as mind, is very helpful. Begin to have that kind of skill where I see a certain kind of mood that has been a part of my life many throughout my life, and I begin to just know, oh, this is just a mood, and the mind wants to go into the perceptions and thoughts around that. No, this is just a mood, and I make skillful choices from that awareness. I make skillful choices of thinking or doing in skillful ways. But this is the beginning of practice in many ways, and it's also sort of the end of practice. It doesn't mean that we don't do things. We do. We can think skillfully. So my suggestion to myself as I try to use language, watchful, available. So do things. I do things to stimulate that fully conscious. And then if I have a very difficult decision on a few emails, I had to make a kind of decision about something, and alarm bells go off in my mind. Be careful, in a really difficult decision. Thought about it. So that's a skillful use of thought. What's the consequences of this? If I do that, what could happen if I do this? And then dilemmas are that way, aren't they? Otherwise they wouldn't be dilemmas. So we all have dilemmas, and we have to think it through, and we don't know what the result is going to be. So we can just go to uncertainty. Oh, what am I going to do? I don't know. Should I do this? Should I do that? Or we can stop and we can make conscious, okay, what do I feel now? Oh, I feel nervous, uncertain, okay. Have to make a decision. Okay, try to think about it. This is that, and that is that. And so we have to make decisions and conscious decisions. But the more we are aware of where we're coming from, like if in that decision I made, I was not aware of fear or uncertainty or whatever it is, and I just make a decision from that energy, then of course it's usually disaster. But if I'm fully conscious, yeah, this is uncertainty, and I allow that to be the way it is, and pause, then I have a chance to think more clearly, to think about the past and the future. But now it's not just an ego reaction, right? It's not just habit. It's considered, it's mindful, and then if I make the wrong decision and I get the consequences of that, I can say, well, for the information I had, that was the best I could do. And there's something about that which is very peaceful, because you can't always make the right decision. But the more considered my mind is, the more conscious I am of where I'm coming from my decisions, the less I'll be crowded out by doubt and self-blame. Life is that way. You make mistakes. It's just the way it is. So not to be just driven by these energies of delusion, energies of ego, energies of self, and to know them just as they are. To be the witness, to be the knowing, to be the knowing of change. This is a beautiful practice. It's very simple, but incredibly subtle, really. If you think about like how fully conscious were you for the 45 minutes of meditation, you see that quite often, 45 minutes is there's a lot of not being fully conscious as our minds mutter on and do what they do. So it's not, you can see why it's such a difficult practice. It's not complicated. I don't think it's complicated, if you understand it. But it is, it has a kind of arduousness that you have to keep applying yourself. You have to keep doing it, a kind of inner vigilance which you need to bring up into the mind all the time. But as I always say, what else is there to do? Yeah, I mean, you have to get the grass cut and, you have to do all of that. But what else is there to do? It seems like it's the only real ball game there is, so might as well get good at it. So it's a challenge rather than like, oh no, I got my adolescent mindset again. And, it's just a challenge. Can I be fully conscious to this? This is the way it is now. So it's quite, I think that's the compassionate aspect of it. That you're not just trying to beat yourself into enlightenment, but you have enough compassion to say, well, look at that. There's that guy again. Haven't seen him for 20 years. Come on in. Coleman Barks has a lovely Rumi rift on that, where some horrible demon comes knocking on his mind and Rumi says, oh, come on in. Haven't seen you for 40 years. Come on in and have a cup of tea. And so full consciousness also has an implication of compassion in it. It's not simply kind of cerebral analysis or willful suppression or willful hanging in, kind of going to tough this one out, but it has heart in it. It has to have heart in it. It's the only thing that makes sense. Okay, I'll leave that for your reflection.
Andamayangamakataya sadhukarangaramase
sadhu sadhu.